Sometimes husbands and wives do things, and they seem to be out here, and then they come together without any consultation on my part. My charming wife, our choir director, our minister of music picked this morning, Earth Was Given a Garden, as one of our hymns. And I'd like to start it off. You sung the song, listen to the words. Earth was given us as a garden cradle for humanity, tree of life, and tree of knowledge, place for our discovery. Here was our home for all your creatures, born of land and sky and sea, all created in your image to live in harmony. And my editorial comment is, until us Homo sapiens got hold of it. With that, I'll say good morning and tell you in advance, I am neither a preacher nor a theologian, and those of you who know me know that for a fact. At best, I am a retired pollution specialist, an administrator who has plowed the area of expertise for the past 48 years, and over the past year and a half, I feel called upon to talk to you a little bit about this, some of the questions on the environment, which it seems to me are the root and at the bottom of the interesting, powerful, profound, spiritual questions of our time. In a book written some years ago called The Age of Missing Information, I found what was the largest television system in the world at the time. It was in Fairfax, Virginia, and had, believe it or not, 100 channels, which seems fairly small compared to the 170-something I got on my machine. The book was filled with all kinds of interesting insights about different things, about history, about community, and how it is that we have developed in some of the things we've developed into. But distilled down to the essence, boiled down to the way Vermonters boil down the sap into maple trees or maple syrup, boiled down just like that, that the message come through that television, every time, every day, and it comes through most of other instruments of our consumer society, it's simple. It's that you are the most important thing on this earth. You are the absolute center of the universe, and everything is going to orbit around you. And when I was in the military, we had a little different way of saying it, but this is mixed company. If you had to pick one message that was effective for building a huge, strong economy, television would probably be it. It has worked incredible wonders. We have consumed and thus produced and raised our standard of living in ways that no one in any previous time or place could even have imagined. Consider the person who was born in 1898 and happens to be alive, what they have seen in the last 100 years. We created here what passes in physical terms for a utopia, where we don't have to work particularly with great physical difficulty, where we live in comfort and convenience and security, regardless of the fact that this particular administration is trying to scare the hell of us with their politically sensitive alerts. But if you wanted to create a message that was profoundly troubling from a spiritual point of view, and one that has made great progress on issues of great importance, especially issues of the environment, particularly difficult ones, you couldn't pick a better one than you are the most important thing on the earth. You are the center of the planet. Of course, the old question is, where do we stand in relation to everything else? Many of you know the book of Job better than I do, so forgive me for running over it briefly. Job, prosperous, a rich man, a good man, always does his bit for the community and everyone else, treats his family well. One day he wakes up and finds himself seemingly cursed by God. His cattle are dying of hoof-and-mouth disease. His children are dying. His property is taken from him. He ends up living in a dung heap on the edge of town, covered with oozing sores. As one would in such a situation, he begins to question why this would happen to him. His friends come and visit. representing the orthodoxy of the day, and they tell him it must have been because he has sinned. And they tell him he has sinned, even though he doesn't really remember sinning, particularly sinning that badly. He must have done something, and now God is punishing him. Of course, this was the standard operating procedure of the day, the standing operating belief. If ill fell on you, it was God's wish. Job, surprisingly, won't take an answer for this. He keeps saying, but I didn't do anything bad. I know I didn't. There must be some explanation. Then he demands, which is fairly an audacious thing to do, demanding something from God. He demands an interview with God. He wants God to come justify himself to Job. He demands this in increasingly belligerent language through this long book. And finally, God appears. God appears speaking from a whirlwind, from a tornado. And it's an amazing diatribe. God embarks on this. Job has stirred up a hornet's nest. God is very sarcastic and keeps telling him, where were the waves when they were breaking? Do you know where I should send them and where they are going? Do you know where I keep the hail and the snow? Do you hunt game for the lioness? And on down the whole list. It is a beautiful piece of writing. It is the first piece of nature writing, at least in the Western tradition, and probably the most beautiful and biologically accurate and sexy and crunchy and just an amazing piece of writing for the Bible. I'll leave that alone. See me in private for my own private commentary. On the one hand, the message is clear that Job, and by any extension of the rest of us, are not the center of God's universe. That we are one small part of a large creation, and in some sense, through the straw man Job, cut down to size in the course of this exercise. But that's not the only message. The other message is that this world, which we are part of, is incredibly beautiful. A spaceship spinning through the universe. Why? We have no idea. A lot of speculation. But it is the beautiful place and the only place in the universe where you can eat chocolate. It is full of meaning, sweetness, and beauty. Do you show the hawk how to fly, stretching his wings to the wind? Do you teach the vulture to soar and build his nest in the clouds? He makes his home on the mountaintops. On the unapproachable crag, he sits and scans for his prey. Far off, his eyes can spot his prey. His little ones drink of its blood. The unburied are his. These things that in some senses are so vile to us are clearly due to God. The world is not always as we see it through our own particular lenses of justice and righteousness. Then God asked Job, has God's accuser resigned? Has he swallowed his tongue? And Job simply says, I am speechless. What can I answer? I put my hand on my mouth. I have already said too much already. No, I will speak no more. Which seems like a good, reasonably good answer in that particular situation. And that has been one of the profound ways in which human beings have understood the relationship with the world from before that time and from that time forward. And there is some force larger than us, perceived in the operations of the universe around us. That's one of the ways that we have managed to remind ourselves to keep our ubris within at least some bounds. In our times, the answer is changing. The answer is disappearing. Human beings are putting themselves not only at the center in the sort of ways that they always have, in our pride, in our appetite, but also increasing in the absolute chemical reality of the planet on which we live. And with that, we start having problems. Let's take an example of climate change. Right about the time of the Industrial Revolution, human beings began burning large amounts of coal, gas, and oil. And there's a thin little book, about 50, 60 pages. Read it. It's called The Age of Coal. And with the age of coal, holy hell broke loose as far as the environment is concerned. Diseases that we never anticipated appeared. Clouds appeared in cities. White shirts were black within 15 minutes after you put them on. Things started going downhill. About the time of the human Industrial Revolution, human beings began burning large amount of coal, coal gas, natural gas, and finally oil, carbon-based materials. These saurians, which we're just singing about, having decomposed many, many millions of years ago, are now being pumped up to the ground and burned. One effect is obviously the kind of pollution we are used to: smog, particulate clouds, photochemical reactions in the atmosphere, oxidizing atmospheres that cause an increase in health problems, asthma, cancer, brown lung disease, a rise in the planet's temperature, something we have been working on in California since 1947, and I got into the act in 56. The major effect is that when you burn these fossil fuels, you release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Now, carbon dioxide in a can of Coke, nice tasting stuff. And carbon dioxide can be used for a lot of good stuff. Frozen ice, keep the ice cream and the stuff and all the picnic stuff nice and cold on your way out. It's a colorless, odorless, non-poisonous gas, the concentration of which in this room is higher than it will be outdoors. Because with every exhale that you make, you're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere. And this, the atmosphere concentration of CO2 was about 275 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution. It is now about 385 parts per million. And within the next 20 years, we are now expecting 500 parts per million. Well, what does this all mean? The reasons are critical and urgent. This is a defining moment of history, the trajectory of global crisis in times of poverty, environmental degradation, monopolization of domineering power, and wealth by small Western elite has grown alarmingly in the last few decades. And when you add the industrialization of China and industry, it scares the devil out of you. There is a growing world consensus about the direction that needs to be taken to ameliorate this crisis. Humans must convert their economic system toward more sustainable ways of living together. This particular administration, however, represents an extreme reactionary set of policies that oppose every aspect of what needs to be done to lessen this crisis and begin to turn it around. They seek to set in stone a global imperial regime that will exacerbate every aspect of this crisis and therefore assure violent debacles of inter-human conflict and environmental crisis. Because of the lack... let me back up. In a historical lawsuit, 8 states are suing the nation's top 5 electrical companies for their contribution to global warming, citing that the federal government has refused legislation limiting CO2 emissions that causes global warming. The states have taken matters into their own hands. These companies, which operate 174 power plants across the country, produce 650 million tons of carbon dioxide each year, which is 10% of the country's total CO2 emissions. They have been targeted because they are the top producers of CO2 in this nation, according to the recent EPA studies, Environmental Protection Agency studies. Additionally, there are 218 cement manufacturing plants in the United States, which produce another 8% of the nation's CO2. all of which I've had a lot of fun with in the last 10 years, going in and out their doors and being shown the back door as quickly as possible. There is an urgent need to reverse the trends toward global warming, air, water pollution, deforestation, disappearance of species, and toxic waste that erode the fertility of this land. The Bush administration has withdrawn from the Kyoto Climate Treaty and continually undermines every environmental law that has been developed in the United States and worldwide toward ameliorating this crisis of environment. I thought the Nixon administration was bad when they shut down the EPA, but this particular administration has done it in a slow manner by administrative doctrine of just about killing every environmental law where we can get ahead of the environmental crisis. Another 4 years of this administration could be a disaster for human life, making it much more difficult to turn around what is absolutely necessary and urgent. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported in 2001 that in this century we can expect to see the global average temperature increase from 4 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. That would take it to levels higher than it has ever been in human history. Indeed, than it's ever been long before human history. The worst case scenario in this century, and just in one century, if everything tops out at the upper end of the parameter, we could see a temperature increase as high as 11 degrees Fahrenheit as a global average temperature. The planet would go have a global average of 59, would go from a global average of 59 degrees Fahrenheit to about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. If that should happen, today we expect a nice balmy 82. Tack on another 10 to 15 points for a summer day here in Southern California. Tack on a wintry morning when we bundle up and we go out and it's 52 degrees. Tack on another 10 to 15 points. The clothing industry, as my father would say, the schmata industry would go to hell in a handbasket. I'll explain the word later to you non-Jews. Any of these changes are completely unacceptable. We know that they are unacceptable because we have already raised the temperature 1 degree Fahrenheit, and we have begun to see what happens when you do that. For instance, one of the things that happens to the planet, it gets a heck of a lot stormier. Lo and behold, Florida. And a lot wetter. In the last few weeks alone, enough rain to go through Cornwall, England, where they have never had a flood, and cars floating down the street. New England, 3 weeks ago, floods in towns such as Lexington, where they've never had a flood. For instance, one of the things that happens is the planet gets a heck of a lot stormier and a heck of a lot wetter. That's because warm air, in the fashion that God designed this planet, warm air holds more water. Or as I used to say in New York, more water. W-A-D-E-R. Had to drop the D when I came to California. That's because... So if you increase the temperature, a lot more evaporation takes place in arid places, and you get a lot more drops. The water gets into the clouds, and it has to come down someplace. And so it comes down in a lot more precipitation, a lot more deluge, a lot more flooding. Severe storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a short period of time, 24 hours, 2 inches of rain, just is holy heck. We get the Hawaiian Express here in Southern California, and we get 2 to 3 inches in February and March, and the LA River just goes crazy. And then the hills come sliding off the houses come sliding off the hills in Studio City and Encino. And having been one of those people, my house slid in 1978. So I came to Orange County. The water gets into the clouds. It has to come down someplace, and it gets a heck of a lot more wet and a lot more precipitation. Severe storms that dropped 2 inches of rain in the 24-hour period have increased 20% across the continents against the baseline. There is a very large increase in basic physical phenomena in the last 25 years. Consider what is happening in cryosphere, at the cryosphere, to the frozen parts of the planet. Every glacial system in the world is now rapid retreat. And remember, this is only a 1 degree rise in global average temperature. It is almost apparent by the year 2015 that the snows of Kilimanjaro will be completely melted and it will be a rock top. Glacial National Park will have no glaciers in the year 2030. My wife, Judy, and I were in Alaska several years ago, and where there was once a huge glacier, there is now a frozen lake. It's retreated over 3 miles. The ice cap over the Arctic has thinned 40% in the last 40 years, and we have tremendous amount of data to prove this because we ran nuclear submarines under that ice pack during the Cold War. And while they were checking around with the Russians, they were also measuring the ice. These are unbelievably large changes in very fundamental elements of this planet in a very short time. They come with real consequences. Let me call it like it is. Things are happening in large measure because of us. We in this country burn 25% of the world's fossil fuel, create 25% of the world's CO2. It is us. It is the affluent lifestyles that we lead that overwhelmingly contribute to this system. It is a crime. Crime against the poorest and most marginalized people on the planet. We've never figured it out, though God knows we've tried a more effective way to destroy other people's lives. It's a crime against the rest of creation, against all other interesting corners of God's brain, against the lion, against the antelope and the vulture, and you can go on down the list. Let's talk about coral reefs. I'm sure some of you have been around the coral reefs, taken vacations in the tropics, dived in the coral reefs, enchanting beyond belief, an ecosystem almost impossible to imagine in its jewel-like beauty and its sort of gentleness that you could sort of be in there and just swim around with the fish and just feel absolutely in a beautiful situation. Once these coral begin to die because of the warming of the water, the reefs disappear. The fish population disappears. The small animals that create the reefs disappear. Coral reef researchers issued a kind of manifesto back in 2001 urging people, please, to take into account what was going on, or at least in 50 years, our only record of this world beneath the waves will be film, pictures, and things that we've made of them. In the high Arctic, the polar bear, this incredibly incarnation of the other of our fiercest of brethren, uninterested in Homo sapiens, unless they're very hungry. The polar bears in this large part of the Canadian North are about 20 pounds skinnier today than they were 10 years ago. They lost all their weight in the last decade because as you melt the ice pack, it becomes incredibly difficult to hunt seals. And that's what polar bears do for a living. No ice pack, no hunting, no polar bears. It is a crime against the future, against everyone who is going to come after us. No one has figured out a better way to permanently alter and degrade the world around us as we have. We are going to strip mine the future. If we can imagine how we would feel about people who have done that to us several generations ago, if it had happened then we can imagine how people one day consider us in this regard. Again, we must do something soon. At this very moment, very few of us are doing anything about it. Let me inject a note of hope. Through our scientific system has done a tremendous job of alerting us of the dimensions of this problem. The political system Our cultural system so far has yet to respond in any meaningful way. The reason it has not responded goes back to the question at which we began. As long as we consider ourselves to be enviably at the center of everything, and our immediate comfort and gratification are the most important of all tasks, it is extremely unlikely that our current or future politicians will rise to the occasion and demand of us any real change. For those of us who were around during Jimmy Carter's days and he said lower the thermostat to 68, you thought he was crazy. Jimmy Carter survived, and so did we. And Jimmy Carter was right, but today, all forgotten. So that's where you and I are right now. How do we get off the dime? How do we learn to stop putting ourselves at the center of everything? How do we help our neighbors, our culture, our country? How do we understand so that we might rise to the obvious challenge that is put before us in our time? The challenge that is just as square-faced as the civil rights challenge was a generation ago, and the challenge of fascism was a generation before that. I don't have any easy answers. In fact, I should probably stop right now, having alarmed and scared the heck out of you. Let me suggest that the risk of getting in trouble, me get in trouble, those of you who know me never do that. Right? Watch the head over there. When I was working, my boss would always say, "What are you doing to get me in trouble now?" I said, "That's what you pay me for." Let me suggest at the risk of getting in trouble that there are a few beginning symbolic but powerful things we could start to do. Recently, the issue of Arctic National Refuge in Alaska came before this country. It is presented as a kind of wilderness development versus oil development, and it's true, it would harm the wilderness to drill in it. But the single problem is that what's underneath the frozen tundra, or what's underneath that big pool of oil, if we bring it out and burn it, what happens? We release a lot more CO2, we heat up the planet a little bit more, we do a little bit more to contribute making the Arctic Wildlife Refuge no longer a place of permafrost and caribou, but a place of muskeg swamp where no caribou will tread. There is a scientific study that came out about a year and a half ago that said if the warming continues, the permafrost will retreat 700 miles to the north. Right now, the permafrost comes across Alaska and about 50% of the way down through Canada. You retreat it 700 miles. The frozen land turns into a swamp. Trees will fall over. The thing that amazed me in the article I read, the permafrost has been a sink for CO2 emissions. What I mean by a sink, it absorbs the CO2 emissions that are in the atmosphere. As the permafrost retreats and the land turns into a swamp, the swamp starts to generate CO2 and methane. And methane is 20 to 30 times heavier than CO2 and is a larger warming problem than CO2. So if we allow... I went a long way from my notes. Give me about 30 seconds to catch up here. So if we do a little bit more to contribute to making the Arctic Wildlife Refuge no longer a place of permafrost and caribou and turn it into a muskeg swamp, something must be done. Coal-burning electric plants failing to modernize their boilers must be modernized. Industry failing to use new and improved methods of making cement, steel, iron, chemicals, petroleum products, because it may cost a little bit more. And you know who's going to pay for that additional cost. Look at the price of gasoline. Research locked up in laboratories because the big conglomerates do not want to invest in modifications to factories, refineries, chemical plants and to regulatory operations. That's what we're talking about in realistic terms and in symbolic terms. What we're talking about is the endless, gullible elevations of necessary levels of comfort and status and everything else at the complete expense of all around us. It's going to take a long time to learn how to climb down a little bit from the heights we have put ourselves. We have been at this work for a very long time. All the witness of our religious gurus, from Buddha to Christ to Francis to Thoreau, notwithstanding, we've done a great job of paying lip service and going about our own way. Now the signals from the physical world tell us that we have gone too darn far. And it's time to turn around in some new direction. We will need each other's encouragement and help in doing that. But our experience and our questions have grown. Changes in the past 50 years, the doubling of the Earth's human population, over 1.5 million people and 1 billion people in China alone. The doubling of the Earth's human population, astounding advances in medicine and technology, new concentrations of power in corporations, expanding knowledge about complex environmental relationships have pushed the human experience into new realms where old answers don't hold up. The technology and ethics that we have depended on still work at the level of many personal relationships, but they are totally inadequate for understanding how we fit into the complex relationship of a new and larger whole. Just as the sciences of needed Einstein, just as the science needed Einstein's insight to understand the vastly enlarged view of the universe, today's regions need new theological insights that will enable us to make sense of a world that we experience in many ways. In a community like this one, our religious communities are deeply important. Almost the only institutions left in our society that posit some goal other than the accumulation of wealth and property for our existence on this planet. Go away, buggy. Take a good care of each other. But don't just take good care of each other. Push each other a little bit. This hard work has to be done fast, and it has to be done lovingly. It has to be done not only with an eye on the temperature around us, but an eye on the temperature inside of us, on our understanding who we really are, not who we've been told we are, over and over again, by all the images that flow through the cable or through the billboard, or any of the other places that we increasingly have come to identify. Our core faith convictions about the purpose of God's creation and the characteristics of human nature are deeply personal and emotional. These convictions define the stances we take on matters of great importance, including the future of this planet.